The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin. If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
And this is episode 58. There's 57 previous conversations that you can go back and listen to, and we would encourage you to do so. But this time we're speaking to Johanna Hedva, Korean-American writer, artist, musician. Johanna has many caps, which we kind of delved into various areas of Johanna's creative work throughout the course of the conversation, including Tom Cruise studies, which is more on that later on.
We had a really great time speaking to Johanna. We had a chat that ranged across splitting your life between two continents, nostalgia for bad coffee at diners, collecting all of the deleted ghosts that you cut from your manuscript and storing them away. So without any further ado, Johanna Hedva.
Well, thank you for joining us. You're in Berlin at the moment, am I right?
I'm in Berlin at the moment. I just got here about a week ago because I split my time between LA and Berlin, and we did the first leg of the book tour. The launch was in LA, so I just got back from touring. So I'm a little bit demolished, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you for making the time. Is there, when it comes to promoting books, is there a sort of difference in the audiences that you get between Europe and North America?
Absolutely. And there's a huge difference in the worlds of like literature versus music versus art. And I have like kind of multiple cloven hooves in different worlds. And so it's a bit tricky to navigate that in terms of where to situate the events and the venues and the context. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I've noticed, I mean, this is kind of like maybe just me complaining about Germany, but like presenting things to German audiences is rough. Like they don't laugh at the jokes. They're very serious. And not just Germans, but like kind of generally like Northern Europeans tend to be pretty, they're a rough crowd. You know, they're cool, slow burn. They don't give you much comparatively to places like in America or like say Mexico or, you know.
A tougher crowd here. I mean, I think I got that from having been to the cinema with an American who was very participatory in the film watching, which is not something I had readied myself for.
Yeah, like for example, you know, in Los Angeles, there's a chain of movie theaters called the AMC, and there's a 1 minute commercial that plays. If you go to these movie theaters, which are everywhere, so that's the movie theater you're likely going to in LA. There's a 1 minute commercial of Nicole Kidman that plays before every movie. And this is iconic, this commercial. She's wearing like a glitter suit. She's coming in out of the rain. You know, like drag queens do this as a number now. She's like, we come to this place for magic. You know, and when you go to a theater in LA and that ad starts to play, everyone in the theater is saying it along with Nicole Kidman. Like, yes! Queen, you know, and it's just that's not what's happening in the movie theaters during the ads.
I can't imagine that in Germany either.
No, I mean, in the south, like I've been to movie theaters to see things in the southern part of Europe, like in Italy, for example. That's a very participatory, kind of rowdier crowd for sure.
And do you find, you said you split your time between LA and Berlin, do you find that any of these differences sort of percolate into your writing, into you? Do you find you're conscious of aspects of either your writing or just generally that you're doing things slightly differently than you would in the other place?
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's definitely a huge part of my existence, just the day in daily life, to have this kind of duality. I have to say it makes me, I think it's the only way I know how to do it, because when I was a child growing up, I split my time between two houses, my parents and then with my aunt. and they lived in two different towns. And so this was always sort of part of how I understood life worked. It's like you spend time in one place and then you leave and go to the other one. And so there is like a kind of feeling of that that I still chase. I feel now like I feel like the other city rescues me at some point when I start to get cranky about the one I've been in for a while.
Because I guess as a child, obviously, you presumably had less say on where you were going. You'd sort of have a schedule to go from one to the other based on other people's desires rather than your own. Whereas now, I presume you could choose to stay in one or the other all year round. But at some point, you must sort of make a decision. Or have you got it scheduled in 6 months from now, I'm going to be on that flight?
Originally, I mean, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. I went to school in Los Angeles. My whole life was Los Angeles. And then I became disabled in my late 20s through a couple of different chronic illnesses that I have. And trying to be an artist, you know, like i.e. broke, freelance, you know, with a high need for healthcare in America is just impossible. It's so brutal there as a country, in terms of the way that the government, well, the way that it does not function. I was going to say the way the government functions, and then I was like, the way it does not function. So in 2016, my partner and I decided to move to Berlin, and basically like 90% of the reason was so that I could have healthcare and survive. And when that move happened, originally there was this feeling of like, I'm leaving LA and America forever. I'm going into exile. It's very sad. You know, it was like, that was the feeling. And then Berlin winters, you know, like literally nearly killed me 2 years in a row. I mean, actually, like I was in the hospital during them. So at some point I was like, fuck that. So, and you know, and still all of my family, all of my friends, all of my history, all of my community, everything is still in LA. And so, you know, it became kind of this thing of like, well, we'll just have to figure it out how I can spend as much time as possible there while maintaining residency in Berlin for the healthcare. So that's sort of the situation. I mean, I've now been here 7 goddamn years, and I feel like that's just too long to be in Germany. I'm going to just complain about it. I'm sorry. I thought I would by now have assimilated a little bit more into the culture, and I have found that the opposite is true. I feel more alienated from the culture here. So it's a bit of a, yeah, it's a bit of a conundrum at the moment.
Is that just from coming to know more about it and understand more about it, you realize there's even more to understand? It's more complex.
Yeah, I mean, culture is a real thing, you know, and there's plenty about American culture that I can't stomach either. You know, I mean, there's plenty about living in America that is impossible for me at this point. But just sort of certain things, like I never really felt a strong allegiance to America, and I still don't politically. But some things I really do find that I miss, like Cheetos, like the diner. There's a certain kind of American diner that I get very nostalgic for. It's like the kind in Twin Peaks. And it's the sort where the food is terrible, you know. But like literally anytime I see a scene in a movie or a TV show where they're at one of these American diners, Pulp Fiction comes to mind. You know, that shitty little mug. It's like off-white. The coffee is just awful brown water. But whenever I see this now and I'm in Berlin, I'm like, oh, I would just pay the cost of the earth to be in that diner right now and have like a stack of pancakes and a burger and like a coffee that tastes like shit. So it's made me like very nostalgic for like really odd things.
Does that nostalgia, do you find you're writing about those sort of things? Like, oh, I'm thinking about those pancakes and an urge to describe and write about them? Or is your writing process sort of a stage removed from that? You have the urge for the actual pancakes, but you're not feeling any need to write about it.
No, I think that place, city, is one of the most important elements for me in writing. Like my second book, Minerva, The Miscarriage of the Brain, which was this very odd decade. It was a collection of a decade of work and the kind of promiscuity around form and genre that's contained in that book is really wily. Like it's a lot of different forms. There's like poetry, essays, plays, documentations of performances. There's an encyclopedia of everything erotic in the world. Like, it's very odd, kind of as a collection. But I realized, like, the one thing that held it together was Los Angeles as a place where all of this happened. So it really became, like, the main character, LA. And then in this novel also, like, Los Angeles and Berlin is where it's set. And each of those kind of presents, like, a, like, the book is split kind of in half. One is in LA, one is in Berlin, and there's a kind of summer in LA and then a winter in Berlin, and it's very important, I think, for the atmosphere.
I guess you do the other way around, though. Summer in Berlin, yeah. And winter in LA.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole conceit of this novel is that it's the inverse of my life. Maybe I could say this, is that when I started writing it, 2014, my little kind of prompt to myself, or like my elevator pitch, was I was like, okay, let's start with like a first person narrator who on paper, say identity demographic wise at the DMV, would check all the same boxes as me. So white mother, Korean father, born and raised in LA, poor as dirt, queer as fuck, kink, went to art school, student debt, really wanted to like be somebody. These are the things that we have in common. But then with this character, at any kind of moment where she has to make a choice, I wanted her to do the thing that I ethically disagreed with, or that I thought was morally or politically wrong, the thing that I felt like I did not do in my life. And part of that was to really reach into the speculative space that fiction affords of like, what would have happened if this went a different way? Or like, what was the story that didn't get told? Or, you know, this kind of distance, I think, between choice and consequence, having multiple fates, for example, that was really like the project of the novel. And so there was something about just inverting. It just kind of became like the exercise was just to invert all the time.
And was that quite easy once you got started? I guess you started in 2014, so you were writing for over a period.
Bitch, I've been writing for 9 years. I mean, easy? I don't know what you're talking about.
Was it easy to keep the thread? I mean, for example, you in that time, I guess you were moving back and forth between LA and Berlin. Did you find you'd sort of write stuff in Berlin, say, and then get a flight, arrive in LA, depressurize from the flight, open the laptop and start reading going, what was I thinking? No, I've got to change all this. I've got a different perspective now. Or, you know, obviously moving between two different places, were you sort of moving between different perspectives on what you were writing? Or once you kind of pulled the thread, I've got what this character is, it was just a case of adding and moving it forward?
I would say that nothing about this was easy ever. And I don't think that that's because I was moving between LA and Berlin. I mean, maybe that contributed to it, but no, it was the sort of thing where I had really never written a novel like this before. The other two novels that I've written, one of which wasn't published, and then my first book was the novel On Hell. They were just really, 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 really different. And it's, you know, whenever I delete something from the manuscript, I put it in like another I put it in one document to just sort of collect all the ghosts of the discard pile. And at some point in the drafts, that document got longer than the novel itself. And I remember thinking like, am I doing this wrong? This can't be right. That I'm like, I've cut hundreds of thousands of words. But actually, I think on this side of it all, I think that is what you do. I think that is the right process. Maybe there are freaks who don't have to do that when they're writing a novel. But for somebody like me, I have a kind of maximalist approach to just like everything, like my life as well as my work. So I just try everything. What would happen if there's a whole scene in here where she's shipwrecked? I don't know, you know, or whatever. Like, I would just kind of do this. And then the kind of process that for me happens is I write 500 words a day, kind of no matter what. It's the first thing I do in the morning before I eat or before I speak or before I do anything.
Is that all in this? You've got a sort of document that you start a blank Word document or on a computer and you write 500 words and then the next 500 words comes after that, and you're also deleting stuff out of that. But there's this just one document?
No, I mean, it's not just like, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. It depends on the project. So I'll do that for like a kind of concentrated period of like months. And then I'll do something else. You know, I'm a musician. So like the other thing that'll happen, this is like kind of like as soon as I wake up, it's like either I'm writing 500 words a day or I'm playing music, like kind of just going to the instrument and starting. And then I'm also a visual artist. You know, I work in the art world quite a lot. So sometimes also it'll be painting or drawing. But what happens with the writing, particularly during the times when I'm doing these other things and not that, is I just sort of let it sit in there. And so with the novel, because it took 9 years, you know, I would do like 500 words a day every day for like, say, 3 months. And then I would just sort of not look at it for a couple months and do these other things and then come back to it. And pretty early, like, you know, with editing or like revising, like I revise as I write. And so, but it's not really, I'm not as rigorous as like I know like Joan Didion, for example, you know, pre-computer. She would like every morning retype what she had already written while, you know, and then revise it as she was retyping and then write new stuff at the end. I'm not that kind of systematic about it. I usually print out my what I've accumulated doing my 500 words a day every couple of weeks, and I'll read it and note and revise by hand on the drafts. I don't know if you can see this. I mean, it's a podcast. We'll have to describe it. But I save all my drafts, and they're up there. And for those that aren't, you know, this is an audio only, but there's just like an unseemly pathological like shelf of paper that I'm showing.
So you get a quite possibly dangerous amount of paper high up.
On the top shelf, I would say, of quite a lot of shelves, that each pile is about a good foot high. There's, I don't know, at least 7 or 8 of them. It looks like a fire hazard. But
and you know what's real, what's even more pathological is that's just from the last, like, maybe like since we moved to Berlin, that's like the last 7 years. So the rest of my life is in a bunch of Tupperwares in the basement. They're like so many. There's just a lot of paper that I'm dragging around the world, in other words.
what's the thinking behind keeping it? I mean, do you go back and refer to it? Do you see how the sort of iterative process has worked, or is it just the habit of how you do it and it's a way of visually seeing your progress?
No, it's absolutely like I keep it for weird future moments. Like I really do believe in fate. I really, you know, I'm a witch and the whole thing. So I really do believe that like those things will come back to me when I need them. Also, it's just a matter of editing by hand. Like you put notes in there. Like I have like, you know, a lot of paper with like notes by hand. And those are very important for me to keep, because sometimes I'll just be digging around and I'll be like, I remember I had an idea for something and I wrote it in the margins once. It's like, it's a kind of like a, also I have to say, it's like, I do have a kind of mythological romance about these things. Like, you know, Fermat's Last Theorem, this mathematician in like his marginalia in his diary right before he died, he wrote some little thing in this on the side that said like, oh, I've managed to solve this like impossible theorem, but I don't have the space to write it here. And then he died. And then like there were hundreds of years of mathematicians trying to solve this problem. I love that. I like hope that one day that might happen with my like papers.
But with the document that you have where you put the stuff that you cut out of it, I mean, two things, I guess. Do you ever print that out and write notes on it? And do you go back to it? Or is it a sort of fallback just in case you remember there was something there that you want to bring back?
I don't think I've ever printed the whole thing out, but it's absolutely, there is this kind of like bank account, because I'll remember, I'll be like, no, I cut that scene. Where is it? And I'll go back and get it again and kind of move it. It's like transferring money from the savings account to the checking account, you know, where I'm like, oh no, that actually works now. I'll put it back. And there's a lot of this kind of transfer that goes on for years.
So you write 500 words a day and then you get, I don't know, say 4,000 words or something, and print it out. And then with that 4,000 words, you'll annotate it on paper. And I'd imagine, you know, sometimes it might be a line through a whole paragraph, get rid of this. And that's easy to, you delete it from the document and move it to the backup document. But I'd imagine there's lots of places where it's kind of just a subtle change or something, where you're not necessarily deleting the whole paragraph. You just want to change the order of some words or something. Are you then also copying that paragraph because you've changed it into the other document?
Copy editing, like kind of little phrases and stuff, maybe not so much. But I'll save a phrase for sure. If it's a couple of words in a particular order and then I try changing them, I'll save the...
So it's not right for here, but I don't want to get rid of it forever. So it's going in the other document.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also it's just sort of like, I just don't really... For example, you can see me sitting in this room full of books, which is also a pathological amount of books for a tiny room. When we moved from LA, we brought no furniture and 3,000 books. And that was 7 years ago. And so now, like, the amount of books is doubled. The reason why I have so many books is because I write in them. And I don't just underline things or write notes about what I'm thinking about the book itself. I write when I bought it, where, who I was with. It's sort of like I've been saying, like, my only dream for my life was to have a library in my house. And now that I have one, it really functions like a kind of nice prosthetic that I can plug into my brain of just more brain space. It's just like additional gigabytes of storage, because I'll be like, oh, right, like that idea or that thought, I wrote it down. I remember the book, you know, I was reading when I had that thought. And then I also reread quite a lot. And so rereading in the same book where I can see all the notes from the first read is also very important to me. So it's just sort of like, that's just like the way that my methodology through the world, it works with writing, but I also do it with a lot of other things. And it means that I seem like I have an amazing memory. And, you know, and I do, but it's just because I literally write everything down. I like you guys, it's like, I'm insane. I mean, I write down here. Wait, I'm going to show you something crazy. We'll also have to do an audio description for the viewers. I write down everything I do every day in a book that's just scribbles, a little Unabomber vibes, no margins, just every single thing. And then I also write down all of my dreams and save those. And I write a lot in a journal by hand every day. Like, it's just a little logarithmic.
I'd like some breakfast. We stopped serving breakfast. I know you stopped serving breakfast, Rick. Sheila told me you stopped serving breakfast. Why am I calling you by your first names? I don't even know who you are. I don't want to be your buddy, Rick. I just want a little breakfast.
What language did you conduct this conversation in, Peter?
German. Ich. Nichten, lechten.
Presumably you mean, rufen Sie ein Taxi, bitte, sonst verpasse ich meinen Flug.
Yes.
No, you don't, Peter, because that means, get me a taxi, I'm late for my plane.
Do you have a sort of order of where... Like you mentioned, sort of writing in a book, you have an idea and you write it in that book, and then you remember that you're reading that when you had the idea, so that's, you know where to look for that particular note. You have that journal you write in that you've just shown us. Do you find you sort of quite specific about where you're writing, what sort of idea, which sort of ideas go in which sort of place, or will you just sort of grab anything that closest to hand? If you're just sort of in the kitchen and have an idea, will you think, oh, I need to go and get that journal because it goes in there? Or will you just grab the back of a packet of cornflakes and write
them out? I have a big, like, my journal that I always use. I use the same kind. I'm like keeping this company in business because I have, like, you know, dozens of these. I use one of these giant black leather bound things. And then I write in here all the time. And it's notes, it's to-do lists, it's my tarot that I do for myself every new moon. And then it's also just like all the ideas that I'm working through.
Are you
writing,
rewriting?
Like, for example, right now, my next book is due on July 7th. Ooh, I'm writing quite a lot in the journal to just sort of think about structure, think about what's not in there yet that I got to remember to put in there. If there's a like if I'm in the kitchen, to answer your question, and I'll be like, oh, that would be a great phrase or sentence for that thing, I'll write it in that big black book. And then I keep that big black book with me, like, on the desk when I'm typing things into a computer.
If you have things that you realize are appropriate or essential to go in that large journal, but you're out and about, would you write that in another notebook and then transcribe it into there? Or are you happy that between your books you can follow the flow with the thoughts?
I love the minutiae of the craft talk on this podcast. It's great. I usually, if that's happening, then I'll write a note in my phone and email it to myself. And then I'll often print out the email and put it in the big black book, because then it'll have the time that I had it. This is very important to me on some level too, like the date and the time. So the notes app on my phone, this is also where I write down my dreams every morning. And then I email them to myself and print out the email so that I can see. It's also a way of seeing what time I woke up every day. I sound crazy. But you know, it's like,
you sound like you're a fan of admin.
Well, this is what I'm trying to say, though, is like, I'm really not. And I think I do this because it kind of helps my memory. It helps me organize stuff. It helps with the stuff that I'm bad at in terms of admin. It gives me a very locatable, corroboratable place and time that something happened. And so then I have like a better memory about it. I'm like, oh, right, that I was thinking that last March when I was reading this book and I was in this place. You know, it's a kind of like way of documenting and evidencing a continuous existence. Because otherwise that stuff would just get all, it would not be chronological time. It would be chironic time. There were these two different kinds of time to the Greeks. Chronological was based on the god of time was named Cronus. So we get chronic, chronological from him. This is like this kind of linear, the kind that goes forward in one direction and is really a drag. And you understand that it's linear time because materiality decays, you know. It's like second law of thermodynamics. Like everything is going to go to shit, you know, and that's how you know time is moving forward. But there was this other kind of time called chironic time. And the word kairos in ancient Greek meant fate. So it was a kind of more cyclical, haunted, maybe chironic, faded, right? Idea of time being something that returns and you can't really chronologically count it, but you can qualitatively count it. And what's interesting, just as a footnote, is in modern Greek, the word kairos means the weather or atmosphere. And I think that's gorgeous that it went from meaning fate to meaning just like the atmosphere, the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how many words go, dig into the etymology and they mean the diametric opposite of what they do now. It's just the way language goes, I guess.
I assume you're not petty enough to use... I was talking to someone the other day about how in conversations in pubs, the mobile phone and access to the internet has got rid of someone really definitely saying that such and such is the capital city of whichever country, because you can go, I'm not sure that's right, and check it. So now the arguments are, oh yeah, when we went on holiday to Crete in 1998, and the other person's adamant it was 1996, whereas you've got the actual receipts. So you could be like, I think you'll find it was the 26th of May, 1996.
But it's like being petty with myself more, you know, because I'm like, oh, right, I did that then. That's not what I remember, you know. That's like definitely not.
Yeah, there's something compelling though about that level of detail. If you think that, you know, you sort of get to experience this once, or you know, whatever you believe, to actually kind of keep track of that and things, I think there is something very interesting about that.
Well, I stopped doing this thing where I was writing down everything I did every day for years. I did it for 4 years in my 20s, and then it just started to feel really, really demoralizing, because when it starts to accumulate and you just see it's like real kind of boring, you know, you're like, oh, I just did the same damn thing every, like nothing happened, you know, it's just pretty bleak, where you really see the kind of ritual of banality that is every day. And then I started it again during the pandemic, actually, because it was a way to just sort of mark time, you know, when time was feeling really slippery as well as oppressive, you know, for all of us in lockdown. And I just started to do it. I started to do it. This is like, to be really honest, because during the pandemic, I started Tom Cruise studies, which was to watch every Tom Cruise movie ever made. And there are like a lot, you know, like a lot. It's like, I think more than 100. So I had to write them down to remember which ones I had already seen. And I started to just write like kind of annotations around the day. It's like, oh, today we watched Cocktail and we went to the market, you know, because this was lockdown. You would go to the market like once a week. And then the next day was like, oh, and then we watched The Color of Money and, you know, it rained or whatever. It was just this very mundane kind of thing. But then it just started to become more like embroidered with the rest of the context of the day. And then, yeah, now I'm still doing it beyond Tom Cruise studies.
have you finished his entire oeuvre? Huh?
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately. I mean, but I have I don't want to take up any more time with Tom Cruise studies because I have like sofa pontification about why he's the greatest movie star alive right now. Like, I really believe this. I did a thing actually for the UK. There was an interesting art project going on during the pandemic where there was money to give artists like support to make like an hour of TV for like a kind of it's just like an interesting little art project. It was really cool. There were a lot of really interesting episodes, and I did mine on Tom Cruise studies. So I already did an hour of content of why he's so amazing and why we love him and all of that. So
I've got a friend actually who's working his way through the back catalog of Nicolas Cage movies, which I don't know how many there are, but I'd imagine
that's probably
it's a similar
great studies. Yeah. Well, I have to say I do this for a lot of people. Tom Cruise studies was just one of many, 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 many. At the moment I'm in Cillian Murphy studies because I'm going to be writing about Oppenheimer. And Nicolas Cage studies, there's a great book about Nicolas Cage. It's called Nicolas Cage, National Treasure. And I highly recommend people read this book. It's I agree with the argument. Yes. National Treasure. Yes.
he's definitely distinct.
Yeah.
How did you, I mean, I'm asking this mostly because I wonder how it relates to how you then find the sort of material subject matter and sort of prompts for your writing and other creative work as well. But how did you settle on Tom Cruise? Or, I mean, with Cillian Murphy, obviously, if you're going to write about Oppenheimer, there's something that led you to that. But,
well, that was just sort of the lead. Like, I was already doing Cillian Murphy studies, and then it was like, oh, and then Oppenheimer's coming out, so then I'll like have a deadline, you know? Well, my main methodology is an obsessive one. I think that that's becoming clear. I'm talking about how I obsessively write down everything I ever think or do. But particularly with the studies, like, so there's a distinction in like my kind of lexicon between falling in a hole and then doing studies. So I fall in a lot of holes. Those happen all the time, and they last like, you know, for a couple of days, like a couple of weeks. It's like all of the Mohawks that Grace Jones has had. Like, I want to get all those photos in a folder on my computer. So that's a hole. Pierre Bonnard's cats, like the way he painted cats, always really freaky. Like, I need all of those images in the folder on my computer. The studies are more sustained. They're much more sustained. For example, Nine Inch Nails studies resulted in a 15,000 word essay that the White Review published a couple years ago. You know, 15,000 words. Like, and it took me, I mean, that thing had 80 drafts. I mean, that was a really, and that's a lifelong studies. I've been a fan of them since I was 10. Buffy studies, I think, is where I get the name. There is an academic field called Buffy studies. And, you know, I have seen that show, the entire series. I've rewatched, I think, 6 times now as an adult. But something like Tom Cruise studies or Cillian Murphy studies, or I also did Catherine Keener studies recently with actors. What that is primarily about is a question of what do these people mean to us? Like, archetypally, like, what do we look to Tom Cruise for? What does he give us? And how is it different, say, than, how is Tom Cruise different, say, than Leonardo DiCaprio or Christian Bale or these other figures that are looming very large in the collective, unconscious and conscious? I really, you know, some of them are propelled by like dislike. You know, where I'm like, what the fuck? Like, why that guy? Or like, why is that person not just famous, but like, why is that person beloved? That's a big like kind of question that propels all of this for me. So like with Cillian Murphy, it was sort of more like, here is somebody who's kind of not necessarily had his leading man A-list movie star moment yet, even though he is that. But like, why isn't he at the level of Tom Cruise? Because, you know, he was in Peaky Blinders, but this was like TV. And yes, it was amazing prestige TV. But it was a little like Cillian Murphy, for whatever reasons, and I'm really thinking about why, is not Leonardo DiCaprio, Joaquin Phoenix famous yet. And I kind of wonder if Oppenheimer will do that for him. But, you know, he's like 50 now. Yeah, I have a lot of, yeah, armchair theory about why.
I mean, I'd be interested to read it when you've sort of finished. I mean, that that question specifically, I think, is quite interesting. But also that approach and you sort of saying it's studies, I think, is interesting because it's about how they sort of are as a cultural phenomenon rather than watching the film and thinking, oh, I wonder why Tom Cruise chose that role and what he's interpreting about it.
Yeah, no, it's more like, what does this person represent? Who are they to us as an archetype? What are the qualities that they have that nobody else has? Like, for example, the thing about Tom Cruise, to just use him as an example, is that he's got an innocence to him that none of these other A-list movie star male leads have. Well, you know, Joaquin Phoenix, Leonardo DiCaprio, Christian Bale, they have like darkness. They can really play a darkness. They play villains. They play tortured, tormented figures. But Tom Cruise has a kind of childlike wonder to him. And I cannot think of another person in his at his station in his career who could get away with the kind of shit that he's doing in terms of, I don't know if you saw the new Top Gun, but before the new Top Gun, there was like a 2-minute commercial at the beginning, if you saw it in the theater, it was just Tom Cruise like sitting in an armchair talking directly to the camera and just being like, hi, we are so glad that you came to the movie theater to watch our movie. We made it for you. And, you know, welcome back to the cinema. And just, we hope you enjoy this. And, you know, I like, and it works. You're like, yeah, great. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, Tom. You know, and part of that is coupled with this weird Scientology. Like, he really believes in movies as being like the thing that can save us. Like, he's saving Hollywood single-handedly. And one of the things that's really incredible about him is, you know, he does all of his own stunts. And so those Mission Impossible movies cannot get insured by the studio because the stunts are outrageous. He is throwing himself out of planes like 80 times to get the shot. The studio is not going to insure that shit. So he insures them. I mean, this is like another level of like a kind of grandiosity belief in just the power of like what a good action sequence can do. Like, and to be fair, they're the best action sequences in all of film. The Mission Impossible movies? Absolutely. The only ones that rival it are John Wick. And these are kind of a different, they're slightly different because they're, you know, they're much more violent. There's like guns and, you know, the whole choreography of the fighting. But with Tom Cruise, you're just watching like a child's innocence, like be in wonderment about the power of movies. And we don't have that from literally anybody else.
It's direct, which just kind of connects a lot better than a lot of these more violent CGI.
You know, and he's just like his bio on Instagram says running in movies since 1981. And yeah, there's like a mega clip on YouTube of every shot of him running in every movie in chronological order. It's like half an hour long. Yeah, I've watched it more than once. It's great.
When do you, I mean, you mentioned there, is it like studies are sort of a bit more of an extended thing than a whole, but
yeah,
when do you kind of realize you've moved from being in a hole to embarking on studies? Is it something you kind of know from the outset? And I mean, equally for your writing, are you at some point going, oh, okay, I better start the blank document, having already amassed a lot of notes? Or for instance, in your latest book, you said when you had this idea that it was going to be somebody the same demographic as you, but kind of the complete opposite in a way. Was that the start in your mind of writing the novel? And did you kind of open a blank document that very same day and write 500 words? Or were you kind of writing snatches of ideas here and there? And then it was only in retrospect, looking back, oh, right, this is what I'm writing. And I've already written 10,000 words of it. And I see now what I didn't realize I was doing all this time.
I would say that it's probably similar to how you know you're falling in love with someone, you know, or how you know you're going to be friends with someone. It doesn't necessarily, like, falling in love doesn't have to mean romantically or erotically. It's sort of like, you're like, hey, yeah, you're cool. Like, I want to hang out with you. Yeah, let's like get a coffee. And then,
but equally that can happen in different ways. You can have a real friction to begin with and then yeah. almost think I hate this person, and then actually it's the opposite, or you can have a very slow burning.
You might have to expand on how examples of that in your own life. I'd be curious to know the stories of those.
There's lots of different ways people come. In the Hollywood sort of Tom Cruise version, I guess it's normally sort of love at first sight. Two people meet, they see each other, and boom, and sort of metaphorical explosion goes off. But I think in real life there's lots of different ways that people kind of develop relationships, whether in love or, as you say, a friendship. And yeah, that can be more immediate, starting with a bang, or more slow burning.
I think it has to do with a couple of things. I mean, for me to really know what a thing is on the page, I have to have a lot of drafts. I don't write slowly in the sense that I produce quite a lot. You know, like I get to 30, 50 pages pretty fast. But I am slow in the sense of understanding what it is. If it needs to have 30 more pages, if it actually needs to be cut by 15 pages, you know, that part takes me a little bit longer. And it more has to do with the fact that I think that when I'm writing, I'm really writing to see what is possible to think. I'm writing to see, like, okay, if I have a sentence like this that, you know, that builds a thought, what would happen if I change this punctuation mark to a question mark? What would happen if I change this word to an antonym? Like, what would happen to the thought if I were to do this kind of like syntax or vocabulary or grammar or punctuation, like kind of change? And so that is actually the thing that takes the longest, is kind of seeing what is possible to think on the page. And then doing that sufficiently enough to feel like I've excavated a territory around this topic where I'm like, right, so these are the thoughts that can be thought about it. Now, what is it that I want to say? Like, which one of these thoughts do I feel the most devoted to producing or kind of presenting to a reader? And like, for example, with the Nine Inch Nails thing, like that began as an email to a friend where I had tickets, but it was for in another city. It was going to require we got on an airplane and like got a hotel, and it was like 2 days, you know, it was like a whole thing. And my friend who was supposed to go with me, who's a fan, couldn't. And so then I asked this other friend who's like kind of an adventurous sort. I was like, do you want to come with me? And they were like, yeah, but like, I never like listened to this band. Like, what do you like about them? And so I just started writing in an email like, oh my God, this and that and this and that. And then, you know, that email like went to like 1,000 words and then 2,000 words. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should like not have this all in an email, and I should maybe move it into a Word document and start thinking about it as a piece of writing. And so I worked on it as a piece of writing, like as an essay that was really just totally driven by my sheer just love and enthusiasm for this band. Like, here's why I love them. And then I turned in like 7,000 words to my agent. I'd been turning down paying gigs because I was like, I'm busy writing this thing that nobody gives a shit about, like, but I do. So I gave it to her, and she was, and you know, I was like, ta-da, you know, like 7,000 words on Nine Inch Nails and why they're amazing. And she was like, okay, I mean, like, it's good, but if you want to get this thing published, like, we have to cut it like at least in half. And then she gave me a lot of other notes, you know? And so I took all of her notes, except the one about Lang, and instead I added 8,000 more words. And I was like, I can't cut it. Like, the whole point is that it's this ridiculously maximalist devotion. And so in the writing of that, I realized, it took me 2 years to write that piece, and I realized when I got to 15,000 words, I was like, oh, I'm writing a hagiography. This is not a fan thing. This is me being like devoted to, like, hagiography is the writing of the lives of the saints. This is me like having an almost religious spiritual devotion to something. And it was particularly about the touring guitarist, who I would absolutely say is a mystic because he's kind of unknowable. And so I realized in the writing that what I was like, the more I tried to write into it, explaining why I loved him particularly, the further away that legibility was. And that's how I realized this was a hagiography. I was like, oh, I can't actually write about this in a way that it's like the negative. There's an apophatic tradition in theology, the negative, the via negativa. The idea is that you cannot ever say that God is something in an affirmative sense. You can only negate it. You can only say God is not, because it's so beyond language that it can't be contained in it. That's the idea. So I realized, oh, that's what I'm writing. That's why it's so long, because I cannot actually affirm or elucidate why this is cool. I can only show the distance between the articulation and the unknowable. So anyway, I'm just very, very blessed and lucky that the editors at the White Review read it and they were like, we'll publish the whole thing. So it's what I talk about it because it's one of my favorite pieces I've ever written, because it was just purely done because I just love it. Was just enthusiasm, devotion, care. Like, I just loved them.
Talking about it, you can hear, as you're saying, it's sort of like a love affair to start writing on something. You can hear, obviously, you're passionate on that piece. Do you ever, are there any, I don't know, extending the metaphor too far, but any pieces that you've kind of broken up with, you sort of started writing and thought, Jeff, this is great, and then actually it's not working out here. Sorry, but you're staying on the hard disk.
So many. I mean, this is the thing too, is like I make a lot of work, not just writing. Like I'm working on my new album right now. I'm like throwing out songs left and right. You know, that's not good. We're definitely not putting that on there. I make, you know, I work in the art world. I just sent a new body of works on paper to an exhibition in Ljubljana. And the amount of works on paper I sent was like, I think 55 total. And I made, that's half of what I made for the show. I threw out half. So it's crazy. It's just kind of fucking crazy. And I mean, like the joke in the house is that the joke in my house with my partner, me and my cat, is that my cat produces what we call Flausch, which is a more kind of metal word for fluff in German. It's like closer to flesh, but it means fluff. It's just like, it's like thick fur. Mm. So she, at Flausch Industries, she's doing 24-hour Flausch production. And the joke in the house is that Hedva Industries is also just a 24-hour Hedva production, but it's like similar to the Flausch. It's just not much, you know, like even though the productivity is very high, it's not really good for much. Or like you can't like sell it.
It's not a big market for Flausch.
It's not a big market for Flausch. Similarly, the Hedva Industries is just churning out all this stuff all the time. And I think like maybe, you know, like I would say like one out of five things. That's even really a generous, it's more like one out of 10.
Yeah, one out of five sounds a good hit, right, I'd say. But.
Well, that's recent, I have to say. In the last couple of years, like I've started to find more outlets for all of this different stuff. But for a long time, it was, yeah, like one out of 10 would actually find its way into the world.
How important is it to sort of have a bucket that it for things to go into when you're...
A bucket?
Well, I don't know.
Like a real bucket?
I don't know, maybe
just for vomiting and me like in between things. Like, is that what you mean?
No, I mean, obviously you're working across different sort of media, different ideas. So, you know, I guess you were writing the Nine Inch Nails piece. Something occurs to you about the guitarist, the touring guitarist. You're straight away, okay, I'm going to put that in the journal with my notes about, or put it in the document with my notes about Nine Inch Nails. But I'd imagine there's lots of things that sort of sit in between. Oh, this could be something that goes in the next novel. It could be something that goes in a song. It could be something that goes in an art piece. It might be something that goes in none of them. How much are you sort of consciously feeling like, I need to put it into one bucket. I need to put it in the right journal. So I've got four journals here. Which one's it going in? Or does that not matter? And it's...
Yeah, that doesn't matter so much. I just don't rush anything. Like if a piece isn't working, I do not force it. It doesn't matter what kind of piece it is. Like I just put it down and go do something else. And I really think, like I got advice on that when I was a younger person. I was like in my teen years and was like, I want to be a writer. And my parents knew a writer. And she was like, just always have multiple projects going on at any given time. Because if you get stuck on one, just work on the other thing. And something about working on the other thing not only will give you space, but also you'll tend to figure out the problem in the other, in doing the other thing. And I have absolutely found that to be true. And I think I'm just like, it's just sort of my weird methodology of doing, like, it's also with the form, I think. Like, I'm like, the interesting question for me is always like, what would happen if this were a doom metal song versus what would happen if this were a video game versus what would happen if this was a short story versus, you know, a painting. And then like kind of following those things through, because it tends to be like I get obsessed with a particular question or idea. And then I try to ask it in a lot of different genres.
So would you be doing that on, you know, on a Tuesday, you are thinking about what would this idea be like in written form and write 500 words about it. Then the next day, you're still thinking on the same theme and topic. What would it be like in a doom metal song? And you're working on the same sort of substance in a way, but in different forms, and you'll see which one works, I guess.
Ultimately. Yeah, like for, here's an example of like something I'm working on right now is like, I want to write about the House of Psychotic Women for my new book, a project by a film historian that was a book. It's a DVD set. It's now like a kind of curated selection of films on streaming platforms. It's a series of lectures that is kind of, you know, a critical look at how women's mental illness and psychosis is portrayed in horror movies. So I'm writing about this. Also, I have a deadline for an essay on it. You know, I have to do this. But also, I've been working on the new album, and I've been kind of saying that the new album is like succubus folk. It's hag blues for sure. That's like the genre that I tend to sound like. But I've been writing a new song that's sort of depicting, it's trying to think through some of these like aesthetic kind of things that are going on in these movies, as well as I was just rereading this book. I had it here, but now I don't have it anymore. It's basically one of these hagiographical accounts of a female mystic in, I think, the 12th century. And she was doing things that were, you know, by our contemporary, we would call her psychotic, right? Which is why it kind of fits into this research I'm doing for this project, because she was doing things like putting, you know, bricks on fire into her vagina and like, you know, pouring melted wax from candles into her eyes in the name of her love of God and stuff like that. So like now I have a new song on the record that's called She's Happiest When She Stinks. And it's very like, you know, it's the vibe of these movies that I'm watching. But it's coming out in that way, if that kind of explains it.
I mean, would you struggle, do you think, to write or to do music if you weren't able to do one of these other sort of expressions? Like if somebody said, right, you, for whatever reason, you can't do any more music, would you, do you think that would kind of impede your ability to write? Are they sort of linked like that in your head? Or would you just be like, okay, well, I've got more time in the week now to focus on writing, so I guess I'll do more of that since I can.
I think I have an answer that's gonna annoy people probably, which is that like I'm just not impeded creatively. I've never ever had that. I've never had writer's block. I've never not written. I've never not made things. Like when I'm in the hospital, I meet my deadlines even if I'm in the hospital. And it's not because I have some weird capitalist so I have to succeed. It's just because I'm like, literally I wake up and all I do is just sort of produce a big mess of thoughts and questions, and I put them in different forms. I think one of the things as I've gotten older, because now I'm almost 40, that's just been the challenge, is I realize that there's a big difference between that, which I do every day and have done every day since I was a child. Like, I started writing stories when I was like 5. Like I released my first record when I was 15. Like I was just kind of always doing this, like a lot of stuff. But one of the things that's kind of been a challenge as I've gotten older is realizing that that creative thing, that kind of like never shuts off, the sluice, is different than trying to then get it into the world in the sense of publishing, exhibiting, releasing records. That apparatus and that kind of weird process of like professionalization and fucking editors and curators and like you know what I mean, like all of that, all the emails, the contract, all of that, that is a nightmare. And that is something that has only kind of happened to me in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years of like doing more of that. And frankly, I'm really bad at that part. I hate it and I despise what it makes me have to think about. I don't want to do a spreadsheet. I'm up to my cunt in spreadsheets. And the whole point of being an artist is that you don't have to do spreadsheets. But you know how many spreadsheets artists have to do? So many. So, like, I don't know. I'm just trying to, like, sort this out now.
Thank you to Johanna for joining us, and thank you for joining us. Please like, subscribe, give us a nice rating. That all helps to get the message out there. You can learn more about Johanna's work if you look at the notes below this episode. You can find out about the podcast at unsoundmethods.co.uk or at unsoundmethods on X, Twitter. It's probably back to Twitter by the time you're listening.
You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
You can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com or jamiebatchin on Twitter, X, whatever it's called, and at jamie_batchin on Instagram. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.